This episode is brought to you by Carbonite, the leader in online backup. Backup your PC or Mac off-site securely and automatically. For a free trial offer plus 2 free months with purchase, go to carbonite.com. Offer code TWIM. This week on the show, Google sets up a paywall, the government threatens to tear some down, and YouTube offers to let you edit it all online. Right here on This Week in Media, number 188. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex sitting in for Daisy, who is not with us. She's off doing important Daisy things, and so I'm sitting here. But I've got a great cast, as always. Coming to us from, I believe, Los Angeles, we've got Tim Street. Tim, are you at home?
I am. I am hanging out at home today.
Very, very good. And coming in from where he comes in from.
The other coast.
The other coast. We like to
in
call
Connecticut.
In Connecticut. Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon, how you doing?
How you doing?
It's very good to have you back.
Great to be here.
So anyway, we've got a lot of news and not a lot of time to talk about it. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive right into this. First thing, this is breaking news. I mean, people have been talking about it, breaking over the weekend. But since we were putting together our notes and this just popped in this morning, Google's News Pass. Basically on Thursday, it seemed that the word quietly slipped out in the Italian press. This is according to the New York Times, that Google would soon unveil a one-click payment system for content called News Pass. According to the newspaper La Pubblica, Google, which is built on free apps for the most part, is creating the infrastructure for a system that would allow publishers to charge readers for content. Lon, decode this for us. What does this all mean?
Well, it seems like Google is trying to create the app store for the web, perhaps to make Rupert Murdoch feel a little bit better about the impending changes to the media landscape. And it looks like they want to actually develop a system in which people can pay a subscription fee and get premium content, presumably from the Wall Street Journal and other papers that are looking for a way to monetize. And, you know, in looking at it, I see this actually as a huge boom for small independent media producers like me and others, because you know, if we're able to offer our content for free in front of that paywall, and people are looking for a quick bit of local news or something that you know, maybe it's not really something they really want to pay for, it gives a local independent person a tremendous leg up, I think. So I don't see this as such a bad thing.
And essentially, Google has been slowly taking away the opportunities for advertisers to have their own control of advertising and make enough money to make this all work. So, Tim, do you think this is going to be something that is going to be maybe part of the solution for publishers?
I sure hope so. I mean, it looks very promising on a lot of levels. It'll be interesting to see how it integrates with Android and how that whole ecosystem evolves from this and brings more opportunity to all content creators, large or small.
Great. Well, it's interesting to see. I mean, we'll see how that turns out. There's not a lot more news that we can talk about because no one's really announced anything. But it was worth at least letting people know that it's coming. So go out and search for either Google dealing with specifically with News Pass and see if you can find more. But it should be coming out in the near future. Before we go any further, I just want to make sure to thank our sponsor, Carbonite. This episode, of course, is brought to you by Carbonite. And of course, the thing is that people oftentimes ask me, you know, how I approach a lot of this stuff. And our rule is that if you don't have it in three places, two places at home and one place on the cloud, you don't have it. You know, you just never know when that's going to fall apart, when it's not going to be around. And so Carbonite is one of the services that is going to let you back up your files automatically whenever you connect to the internet, your photos, your music, your emails, your financial records, office documents, anything that you need to make sure that you absolutely are not going to lose. You got to back it up somewhere on the cloud. And Carbonite's, you know, a great solution for this. And so it's easy to use. You don't need a lot of extra extra hardware, cables, or anything else. You it's secure. You can decide how secure it's going to be. And it's very affordable. It's $5 a month, or $55 a year. So it's really the way to go. You know, when disaster happens, you got to make sure that you can kind of solve those problems. Now, if you want to give this a shot, if you want to try out Carbonite, you can do it for free. Go to carbonite.com and enter the offer code TWIM. That's carbonite.com and then use the offer code TWIM, and you can give it a shot. You can try for 2 months and just see it. See if that's something that is going to solve your problem. And you gotta, if you're not putting your stuff on the cloud, you gotta figure that out, because you just never know when someone's gonna break into your house. There's gonna be water damage. There's gonna be an oil spill. You know, something like that. So you need to make sure. I don't know how an oil spill would affect your hard drives, but it could. It seems to affect everything else. And so check it out, carbonite.com, and go to the offer code TWIM. All right, let's move on to our next story. This is coming from the senators are proposing to grant the president emergency powers to shut down the internet. The internet. I thought that the reason we built this was so that you couldn't shut it down. But anyway, so a new U.S. bill would grant the president far-reaching emergency powers. This is all according to CNET, to seize control or even shut down portions of the internet. The legislation announced Thursday says that companies such as broadband providers, search engines, or software firms that the government selects shall immediately comply with the emergency measure or action developed by the Department of Homeland Security. Anyone failing to comply would be fined. Tim, do we think that the people who are writing this code actually, or writing this law, actually know what they're talking about?
Well, I'm thinking they should give the president emergency powers to shut down oil leaks first.
Right.
And then maybe we could, move into this territory. I don't know. This thing seems crazy to me at first glance. But then when you step back from it and you think about it for a second, I mean, the president has powers to shut down the highways, right? I mean, they could just shut down the highways if they wanted to. Declare martial law. I mean, all that in theory could happen. I don't know that we necessarily need a law for it, but I guess that way it just makes it smoother, quicker, faster. I'm having trouble thinking of reasons why there would be an emergency for that, because it seems like you'd want to keep it open to get correct information out to the people. But at the same time, maybe they know something we don't.
Lon, do you think that something like this would actually make a difference? Do you think they could actually shut enough of the internet down in an instant to really make it actually work?
Well, it's interesting. I actually spent a good deal of time today emailing back and forth with the communications director at the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. And as it turns out, and they're adamant about this, that this bill is not designed as a kill switch. In fact, they maintain, and I actually looked this up as well, that the Communications Act of 1934, which was also amended in 96, actually gives the president that authority already. So currently now, if there was a catastrophic national emergency, the president could just order everything shut down, wired, wireless, just turn it all off. It could happen now. The committee says that the bill was actually put together because they needed more surgical options, as they call it, to allow for specific areas to be dealt with, as opposed to shutting down the entire network, which, to Tim's point, could actually create more problems than it could solve. So one of the key components of it is looking at what they call critical infrastructure areas. And what those areas are is kind of up in the air because is actually kind of classified because they certainly don't want people who have a desire to harm the United States to know exactly where we're most concerned about. But it could include a backbone for the internet that could presumably redirect things or not. But they said it could be as simple as just ordering that a particular plan of action, whether it's putting a patch into a particular router or turning off access to a particular network node somewhere internationally, or shutting down somebody coming in internationally from doing something. Just really in their intent was to give the president more options as opposed to just being able to shut the whole thing off or nothing at all. And I think that was really the course of action that the committee and the senators involved are trying to take with this. So I do think, though, it's important for people to follow this. This bill has a lot of bipartisan support. There was a similar bill that appeared, I believe, last year that kind of gotten taken back to the drawing board, and this might be the newer version of it. It was surprising, actually. The Electronic Frontier Foundation hasn't issued a statement on it yet, so I'm sure they're probably looking at it as well. So it's not as bad as I thought the CNET article made it out to be. I think it does try to find some balance and give the president additional options.
Do we, Tim, trust the politicians to make a decision like turning off parts of the internet? Do we trust that they would be able to make that decision correctly?
As long as they switch the right tubes off and on, I think we're okay. It'll be fine.
Okay. Well, I mean, the other thing that I have is that, you know, there's a big, when it comes to communication, when it comes to distributing communication, we have a very, very strong amendment called the First Amendment that really says that, the issue that I think you get into is whether being able to shut off communication within the United States, because it's not really like turning off highways. I think one of the real questions is it more like turning off newspapers? Because I think that we're much closer to that when we talk about communication. Maybe we can talk about it as highways, but I think that the real question is whether it is an affront to the First Amendment and whether it's going to be constitutional as you move forward, where you're shutting stuff off that you theoretically, this giving the government this power to do this, I think opens it up for a lot of mischief that I question whether it fits within the constitutional framework. Lon, what do you think?
And well, Alex, I think the committee's position, at least from talking to them today, is that this is actually designed to prevent that from happening. You know, their basis of trying to come up with this legislation in the first place was that really the only tool the president had was to shut off the entire network, that there was nothing in the federal code that actually allowed the president and the director that they're going to put in charge of cybersecurity for the federal government to be able to take smaller portions of either the internet or some network functions offline while maintaining the rest. And, you know, I think their position is, look, this actually improves the situation because we're not shutting down everything. We're just going to address the parts of the network that are in trouble. And they also were very adamant to add that it doesn't even mean shutting things down specifically. It could mean that we're requiring a particular infrastructure component, whether it's a power plant's network. Maybe they'll unplug that power plant's Ethernet cable or apply some kind of patch or prevent a certain group from coming in there. Basically, again, in their words, to make it a more surgical way to approach it as opposed to just turning it all off. I think it's important that people still keep an eye on this. But
I think so too, because I think that the issue is that what's great about it right now is that the government can't turn it off. You can say that you could turn the whole pipe off, but you can't, because it would shut down all the government services too. I mean, it would be catastrophic. There's no way that they can do it. So regardless of whether the government has the power to do it, it practically, in a practical sense, in the current form of what the government has the power to do, it can't turn it off. It literally can't. It can't flip that switch because it's too tied into that switch to do it. So what this is doing is untying that switch and allowing the government to start doing that. So the thing is that it's not taking something that they already had and making it more surgical. In my opinion, it is taking something that they couldn't grab and giving them little fingers that they can. You know, and as I said, I think that the real danger here, and I think the constitutional problems that they're going to come up, is if it gets anywhere near controlling information, it's unconstitutional. I mean, if it's infrastructure, I think you're right. But as soon as you start talking about, I mean, this is always been one of my fears is the government taking control of being able to switch parts of the internet off on and on, because there are a lot of things that, as communication moves forward in a democracy, democracy can be very difficult to manage as communication cycles increase, which is what they're finding right now. And the fact that they're trying to find a way to get a hold of those concerns me. So anyway, what were we gonna say, Lon?
I think what's really interesting about this entire issue and the argument in general is that, you think about the internet, which was designed to be a very multidimensional, hard to crash kind of system, is now to a point where, although it has all this redundancy and multiple network routes and everything else, we are really becoming dependent on a single network for all of this information. And the committee's argument is that this is such a critical part of our national infrastructure that for the president to only have one tool and not many is where they're coming from. But I think, again, that's what the importance is for everyone listening who's concerned about this, to, you know, to keep an eye on the bill, to make sure that as this moves its way through Congress, that things aren't added on that do, you know, risk our civil liberties and other things as well. And I'll certainly be keeping an eye out to make sure that this is about protecting people and not harming rights.
Yeah, I every time I see when people say that they're not planning to do anything with it, I just always remember Social Security when they promised that they would never use those numbers to collect taxes. And then I just get bitter. So Google is to move. Moving on to story number two, Google launches a web-based video editor. So this is once again via CNET. So YouTube users and abusers rejoice. The popular video sharing site has launched a new and basic web-based video editor, thereby allowing users to easily edit their videos after uploading them. So this is only. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this is only for your own videos. You can't go and start mashing up other people's videos. Is that right, Lon?
I believe so. I played with this last night. The only things that showed up were the things that I've already uploaded to YouTube, although I can imagine you could probably download somebody else's stuff and put it back onto your account. A little bit cumbersome, but I would guess that would work.
Yeah. Tim, do you see what do you see are the uses for something like that?
You know, I think this is great for a lot of people. I mean, obviously, in the prosumer world, I don't know that many of us are going to be playing with this tool. I mean, it might be easier to use for video blogging, stuff like that, if you want to do quick fixes while you're on the road. But I think for a lot of people who are doing wedding videos and baby videos and, you know, that home grown type stuff, this is a great option. And one of the things I really like about it is that it integrates with the licensed music that YouTube has in their library. So you don't have to rip music to add it to your video.
And where are they getting the songs that they're licensing? There's 40,000 songs that are available according to CNET.
They got them off CDs. They just ripped them.
They were like, no one's going to notice. We're only a little internet site.
Shows how powerful they are that they can do that and not get in trouble and we go to jail.
Yeah, because they have lawyers, right?
So So
you can use some of the songs that they have there. You can edit your own stuff. Do we think that eventually we're going to be able to edit, maybe possibly mash up other people's videos as well? It seems like that would be a lot of fun. You'd end up with people sitting there playing not only with their own videos but with everybody's videos.
Yeah, this could be a great promotional.
Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, if they allow that and there's some type of opt-in type Creative Commons license or something, I think that'll be great. But they've got to, you know, jump that legal hurdle first.
Yeah, I definitely think that going backwards would be difficult. But I think that if forward, you could say this can be mashed. You know, this is mashable, or this is whatever it is. This is editable. I'm going to make this available. I can see a lot of users who want to put stuff up that isn't their family, that isn't their stuff, that is something they think is funny. Or imagine a whole bunch of people going to a single event, recording lots of stuff that they saw on that event, and then making that all available like a wedding through their own pieces, where everyone can get together and put it together. Or going to CES and covering a lot of things and then letting everybody play with them rather than trying to figure out how to move those files. Lon, do you think that would be useful for people?
I think it'd be useful for people. I think it also could be a great promotional tool that you could, you know, have some company who wants to do the, you know, make your own commercial or something. They throw a bunch of raw footage up and let people, you know, have at it. So I think it's some real potential there. It is a bit limited right now. I think all I could make it do was just cut clips and organize them. I don't even think there's transitions yet or you know, graphic overlays or CGs or anything. But it's great. I mean, I've always been of the opinion that if people can edit video and learn how to do it, it's good for society. So let's hope it continues.
Very good. Also, talking about showing TV and commercials, here we have, this is from the New York Times, this is showing commercials and TV on the shelves and in the aisles of the of your supermarket. So you're walking down the supermarket and you look around and there's people talking to you about Campbell's soup, or there's people talking to you about diapers, or there's people talking to you about whatever those things are, giving you more information. Now, I have seen this future. I've been in this future. So this they're testing it here in Maryland and Virginia. But I've been to Japan, and I just have to say that it's a crazy thing. Now, I'm not sure if it's useful yet or not, because they weren't speaking a language that I have any understanding about. I'd look over. You walk through these grocery stores, and as you and there's just people, you know, like saying all this stuff and yelling at you. And I look over, and I'm like, you know, those, you know, Your Jedi mind tricks don't work on me. I have no idea what you're saying. But they're showing lots of they're, you know, lipstick and everything else and talking about why that makes sense and how. Here's the thing that I thought was really interesting is a lot of times you walk through and you don't understand why would I use that? Why would I use that kind of food? Why would I use that type of whatever? And what was interesting about the videos that I saw in Japan was that it would show you how something that looks a little odd would be used. You know, like this is how you use it with your hair, or this is how you, you know, use this item so that when you're looking at it, you can look at it and actually learn, you know, how that would be used. From a geek perspective, I know that if I put it in Home Depot, I would probably spend a half an hour standing in front of the Dremel section just watching how they, because I look at a lot of those Dremel tools and I go, I have no idea what to do with that, but I want to buy it anyway because it's a Dremel. So anyway, that's a whole other story. So, Lon, do you think this will drive people crazy?
Yes. I hope there's a mute button. And I can tell you from, you know, in my household, having a Dremel video would be a very bad thing for my marriage because I would ultimately buy this tool and misuse it on everything in my home. But how much noise can people endure? You know, I have a local gas station now has video playing constantly.
We were talking about this last week. I saw Gary Vaynerchuk on at my 76.
Right. Yeah, yep. It's actually there's two guys who I know who are local to me here who are doing that all across Connecticut, very successfully. I may add, you know, it's they're offering a great deal. It's you know, 14-inch monitor on every gas pump. They're doing pretty well.
Tim, do you think people are actually going to respond to videos in the grocery store?
Come here, kid. Let me show you how you use these matches with gasoline. It's going to be great. You're going to have fun. It's Minority Report. I mean, it's totally that movie. And I think in some cases, it's going to be great. It's going to be very valuable. And it's going to, you know, really educate and help consumers. In other cases, I feel it's going to be a nightmare. Turn it off, turn it off, turn it off. So, and then you also, when you get into grocery stores, you get into slotting fees. So people pay to have their product at eye level for an adult versus eye level for a children on the cereal aisle. So I think this may open up a whole new can of worms when it comes to the FTC and how we market towards children.
Interesting. Yeah. Because I think that when I thought about what I would like to see that in, it would definitely be areas like Home Depot or areas like the old Radio Shack before it was became just Best Buy, you know. So but the idea where there was lots of like cool geeky things that you're trying to figure out, like how would I put that together and what would be useful there, and possibly having like a kiosk that I can actually, you know, figure that out and maybe control some of that information.
Well, you know, Home Depot has done this off and on for years. I mean, I can remember walking through Home Depot and seeing videos playing about how to build a deck on your back porch. And, you know, here's all the equipment right here next to this display. And I think that's where it really makes sense, because if I'm looking to build a deck and they've got everything right there and they're showing me how easy it is, that's helpful. It's relevant. It's great. But if they're hitting me with crap that I don't want, that I'm never going to buy, it's a waste of my time.
Right. So the key is to make sure that content is solid.
So, and relevant.
And relevant.
And relevant, absolutely. So going up next, we've got the script. Scribd. Do you guys use this script?
Nope.
I've viewed it. I haven't really put any documents on it. But.
So Scribd is allows people to, it's self-publishing. I mean, in some ways, part of this is a question of how this new Google service might affect a service like this. But this lets you publish your stuff. You can either let people have access to it for free. I believe you can charge for it here. You can, you know, and they've got just enormous tens of thousands of documents that are there. They have 50 million unique visitors a month. So it's a very, very large site. Now, what they've done is they have been switching. Now, we've heard about some of these companies switching from Flash to HTML5, and they have set, they're reporting a huge increase in the in the user engagement. So it's not as so much as many how many people are coming, but really how long they're staying, what they're doing. And they're saying a lot of this, they've been doing a lot of things, but they're saying a lot of this has to do with making it available on HTML5, engaging with iPhone users and especially iPad users. And so it seems that the HTML5 move is really working for them, according to them. Tim, why would HTML5 make such big... I've heard a lot of good reasons for it, but in this one, it seems kind of odd when you look at the kind of contents that, that's there. Why would HTML5 make such a big difference for a site like this?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming that there are a lot of people that go to this site in their spare time while they're sitting around on their iPhone or their iPad. And if it's Flash, they can't access it at all. But now that they can access it with HTML5 on an iPhone, iPod Touch, or the iPad, it makes total sense to me why they'd get more views. And you think about it, you're like, well, there's not that many, you know, people that have iPads yet. But in the second month of the iPad being out, I heard that CNN did 5 million video views on the iPad alone. And ABC, I think, did 4 million views in May as well. So, I mean, that's only the second month out with not that many iPads deployed. It's only going to grow from there.
Well, you think part of it is that people who have iPhones and especially iPads are super content users. I mean, they bought them because they wanted to use that content. They wanted to get as much content as they could from the internet, and they wanted a bigger device to do that. Is that, Tim, would you agree? I mean, is it just a different kind of user?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the people, for the most part, that have those devices are exactly what you said. And, you know, I mean, that was the holy grail for me when I heard I could, you know, watch videos. I mean, for so many years, it was tough to, you know, have an editor working on a video cut for me and then not being able to see that video cut until I was back in the office or back connected to the internet somehow. And being able to watch it on my iPhone was a game changer.
Lon, is this just another nail in the coffin for Flash? I mean, is this kind of movement something that Adobe can recover from? Or should they just really focus their tools on developing for HTML5?
I think they should really focus the tools on developing for HTML5. I just pulled it up here on my iPad, and it's actually nice. It's got a little slider here. You can go through pages like you would on its on a Flash-based web app. I mean, it works exceptionally well. So I'm pretty impressed with this, and I actually might use it because it looks pretty cool, and I think it works as well as the Flash app did. And in fact, on my iPad, and I'm sure on Google Chrome, it'll probably operate faster than the Flash app did.
I mean, it seems like what Adobe has is great development tools. I mean, the reason I think Flash has always been so successful has mostly been the fact that there were great development tools for it. It wasn't so much the infrastructure as much as, I mean, the infrastructure helps the development tools. And I think that I don't know whether you could do everything you could do with it in HTML5 that you do with Flash. But it seems like they get, you know, wouldn't be that, I mean, it would be difficult, but it's the same ideas that you want to just simply reroute towards an HTML5 world. Do you think that that's actually doable, Tim?
It's going to be interesting to see how they approach it. I mean, yeah, they have created great tools for people to make stuff, and Steve Jobs has kind of locked them out of creating stuff for the iPad. But if you look at the Wired app that was created for the iPad, that was done with Adobe tools. And they figured out how to get it into the App Store and how to get it approved. I haven't met anybody else that has used that same tool and had the same luck of getting it through the App Store and getting it approved. And I'm anxious to meet those people. So if you're listening, if you're in our listening audience, please shoot me an email, tim@onetimstreet.com. I'd love to check out your app.
Yeah, I thought that the Wired thing was really great. I mean, I didn't really get it at first. It took me a little while to look for the little icons that made it interactive and that added the other pieces. And I still think that we're just at that very beginning when you look at the interactivity. And I think that they really did, to make it work, it looks like it was a lot of, you know, cheating. You know, it's not really built. It's a 500 meg file, and it's not really built. They have different pages whether you're, you know, it doesn't reorganize the page. It changes the pages when you turn your iPad. And so there's a lot of things that aren't very efficient, but I think that Adobe, kudos go to Adobe for getting out there first and really creating a design tool that lets you get something working. Now, what I'm really curious about as we look at that development tool is whether Adobe's going to make that publishing tool available to the general public or whether that's something they're going to keep for publishers. I think that going down the path of making it only available for publishers and trying to create some big expensive business model that's going to try to pay all that back rather than making it just an export out of InDesign is going to be a mistake, because I think that someone else is going to come up with publishing tools if Adobe doesn't. If they don't saturate that market, I think that they're going to have trouble. You know, they got to saturate, they got to become the publisher for the iPad, which I think they can do right now. Do you agree, Lon?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're the market leader and have been for as long as I've been doing media, which, you know, in high school and college and throughout. I mean, Photoshop, you know, they acquire just about every page layout document software out there. So, you know,
I remember using Quark. I used Quark back then.
Yeah, I was a Quark user for a while, and InDesign, you know, just won me over. But, you know, PageMaker, remember they bought
I think
them.
It was more, I don't think it was so much InDesign won me over. Adobe didn't screw up, and Quark was so hard to deal with that it was just kind of like, ugh.
Exactly. It was the performance, you know, and they'd be foolish not to give the, you know, to offer those tools in their software. I hope they would.
Right. Moving on, MTV is looking for their first Twitter jockey. Okay, this is a Twitter jockey. So what you're looking for is I guess they're calling it a twee J. I'm really sad about this. All right. So what they're looking for, and this is according to Paste Magazine, is a social media superstar to use Facebook and Twitter and Foursquare and all those fun little things that those kids use today and relay their findings back to the network executives who are caught in a closed system where they're actually unable to see the internet. They are beta testing the government program that will allow them to be shut off. To me, this seems totally absurd. Because it just seems like that the folks at the top don't understand what's going on, and so they want to hire someone to go out and go into the dangerous areas and then report back to us. Is this the gray matter at MTV trying to peer into the younger world?
I would say so, and it's going to make somebody a very comfortable living. So all the power to them. You think about how hard we all work, you know, launching our respective media organizations, and you know, this would be a nice path to a new career for me, I think. But we had a story about a month or two ago about an insurance company here in Connecticut doing the same thing, a very paying job and with good benefits, incidentally. I think it shows the importance of the fact that these companies are having a hard time getting their arms around the discussions that are taking place day after day, most of them negative about their brand and being able to find a way to engage it. And consumers are becoming a lot more powerful, and people that understand how to develop that relationship will do well. I mean, Comcast has, you know, for all the faults that they have done pretty well on their outreach strategy.
Well, and I admit, I don't know anything about, I mean, I haven't watched MTV in a long time. So maybe I'm part of that gray matter now. I'm getting old. You know, evidently.
I remember when they used to play music videos on MTV.
I remember that, and I used to watch it. Yeah. And here's the funny thing is, I used to watch it behind everything else I did. It was like watching. It was like the radio that I could look up to every once in a while and see what was going on when Twisted Sister came on. You know, so that's going to date me anyway. So Tim, is MTV still cool? Are they losing their edge? Is this trying to kind of get a hold of their younger years?
They are huge in Arkansas.
Oh, very good.
No, MTV's doing great. MTV has a lot of stuff going on, and they've got their hands in a lot of different things. This seems to make total sense. I think it's going to be a little bit more relevant for them in the Facebook world than in the Twitter world. From what I've noticed, Twitter seems to be for the old kids like us, and the Facebook is definitely for the younger crowd. So I think that's where they're going to be able to leverage it to their advantage, unless they start targeting the older crowd on Twitter.
I find that to be fascinating that Twitter isn't for the older crowd. I don't quite understand why, but I do find myself thinking about when I think about an idea, I am finding that I am thinking about it in 140 characters. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you can think about it in 140 characters on Facebook too. But that Facebook's where the kids are. I mean, that's where you're hanging out with your friends. You can see the photos, and it's you don't need a computer to access it. You know, you can access it from your friend's house, whereas Twitter is tied to your mobile device that may be a little bit expensive, and it's also tied to your email. Kids don't really use email. It's kind of a business thing. Mm-hmm. So people that are in business more swing towards that Twitter. I'm finding that I'm spending a lot more time now in LinkedIn than I used to. It feels like LinkedIn has gone through a change and has integrated now with Twitter and Facebook, and it feels a little more friendly to me than it was, say, a year ago.
I just look at LinkedIn as my professional contacts. I mean, those are people, you know, they're people, and it's probably the area that I'm the most picky. You know, with Twitter, everyone's just kind of following me. With Facebook, I kind of go, yeah. And LinkedIn, I get, do I really know that person? You know, I'm a little bit more, you know, if I don't know them, I'm not going to, you know, I don't do any kind of random whatever, because I actually have to figure that out. You know, and so I find myself, and I find it very useful to get a hold of people that I haven't worked with for a long time. It's kind of, it's very, very interesting. Now, speaking of Twitter and tweeting, possibly too far. This is coming out of Utah. So this is Friday morning's execution, of course, of Ronnie Lee Gardner by firing squad. Sorry, I just had to say that one more time. Like, he was executed by firing squad. Anyway, if I ever get executed, I just want to say on the radio, I want to be firing squad. You know, I think that that is the way to go. If I'm going to choose a way to go, that is the way to go. That is so cool. Anyway, so... but the mode of communication using to announce it was the thing that really brought up something. So the sheriff or the corrections director said, I just have to go ahead to corrections director to proceed with Gardner's execution. May God grant him the mercy he denied his victims. So and that is Mark Shurtleff. So. A lot of people got upset that this wasn't the right place to say this. Wasn't the right place to broadcast this. Lon, did he go too far?
You know, this is the question of the 21st century news distribution, because I actually, believe it or not, was not following him on Twitter, but I was following some of the journalists who were covering the story right before that person was executed, because I was just curious about the story. It was kind of an unusual way to put someone to death in the 21st century, I thought. What was most intriguing to me was that a television reporter who was actually covering the execution stopped tweeting right before it was going to happen. He wanted to wait until the press conference after the execution was carried out to continue communicating again. He was actually a witness inside the chamber. So clearly he felt it was inappropriate to continue tweeting. I don't know if they took his phone away or what when he went in there. But this is actually speaks to another issue that's been out there. And there's been some criticism of the White House, because the White House has been doing their own press shop, their own communication through their press shop with actually a weekly video program outlining what the president has been doing. They've had unfiltered interviews coming from the White House, or filtered interviews, as the case may be, coming from the White House, bypassing the White House press corps. And I think we're seeing now that the internet is not only equalizing things for small independent producers like us to produce content, but also for officials who typically had to go through the filter of communicating through the press, who can now do it directly. And the question of appropriateness certainly comes up. Personally, you know, this is probably not the thing. If I was in his position, I'd be, you know, eager to go share on my Twitter feed. I'd probably wait for the press conference to discuss my actions. But this is the new era we're in. We're going to see a lot more officials bypassing the media to get their message out like this.
Tim, is this control, too much control, or is this transparency that we want to see out of the government?
Well, I guess you could see it as transparency. To me, it seems kind of creepy, and morbid. But also, I haven't been following this guy. I don't know what he tweets like normally. I don't, you know, when you follow people on Twitter, you kind of get a handle on how they communicate. Some people are broadcast only. They just put stuff out. Other people are back and forth. They do both business and personal stuff on their tweet stream. So it's out of context. It's really hard for me to comment on whether or not this is appropriate place or not, depending on how he treats his Twitter stream. But that said, it's a new technology. It's a new way to communicate. I think we should expect more things like this in the future. So to me, it doesn't seem that abnormal.
Right. I mean, it seems a little morbid as you look at it on the face. But I think for me, sometimes I would rather know what my government is thinking sometimes, you know, like, you know, so what we're seeing there is a thought process. And I do think that there is a concern for, I think the press corps, I think, is more worried about their business than anything else. I mean, they can talk about transparency, but the issue is that the, that as this, as these ratchets start to go down, where people have access to the internet where they can stream these things, the government, you know, the president doesn't really need them anymore. I mean, the question that I always have is, when was the president just going to do a national address and stream it? You know, they could, you know, they haven't decided to do that yet, but it seems like it's something that they don't really need the press for much longer, you know, to get the word out. And I think that that's a now there's a whole bunch of transparency. The question is, does that really add transparency, or does it get rid of it? If you make the press less important, Lon, does it actually in some way censor them, because they won't be able to survive if they don't have those news items?
Well, you think about too, what if this Google News Pass thing happens, right? And most of the major media goes in that direction, so that you have to pay to get the analysis of what you hope would be an unbiased reporter, versus getting information directly from the White House or from your congressional member directly for free when you go into that Google search result. And I think that's going to be a critical question that will have to be answered or ferreted out through this process, because ultimately, you know, having reliable sources, we talked about that last week, is going to be as critical now as it even more so now, just because there are so many voices we can pick up, as it was before. So this is an issue I think we're going to be talking about quite a bit over the next couple of years.
Great. Final story for today. AOL sells Bebo website at a cut price. Now, yeah, this did not turn out to be necessarily a great investment for, this is according to CNET. So AOL acquired Bebo, which was a possible competitor to Facebook. Not, it turned out. And they paid about $850 million. And the rumor is that they might have sold this out to Criterion Capital Partners, which is a hedge fund in Studio City, for somewhere between $3 and $30 million. So it's going to be a big write-off for AOL. Here's the question I have for you, Tim. What do you do with Bebo now that you have it? What would make it worth $3 to $30 million? What would make it worth anything?
Sell it to Friendster. Be huge in other countries.
Do people use Friendster? I get a Friendster. Like, I, you know, of course, I sign up for everything, you know, once. Yeah. And, you just kind of put your little eggs in there just in case something goes on. And so I put my thing in there, and I get a Friendster, like, connection about once a week. And I always go, wow, they're still opened.
I think Friendster's doing well in Asia. I think they do pretty good there. I mean, seriously, with the Bebo thing, I don't know. You know, It really depends on how engaged that crowd still is. I mean, you look at MySpace, and MySpace is still a value. I mean, they're rebranding the site. They've got a new relaunch coming up pretty soon. I think it's pretty cool that, you know, they're hanging in there and they're doing stuff. But I don't know that Bebo's ever going to make it in the U.S. unless they rebrand it, put it under a different label. And you know how fickle people are. You know, I mean, Friendster was the hot thing, then MySpace was it, and now it's Facebook. How long will Facebook be in power? Don't know. I mean, you look at America Online. America Online in 94 was gigantic, you know? Right. That's how everybody connected to the internet. Right. And
that's how I connected to the internet.
Yeah. I mean, that was the way to do it. That was the only way to do it, really, unless you were Leo Laporte. And
right.
Then you had a different way of doing it.
Right. No, I used to, yeah, I would I would tell you what my AOL login is, except that it's a swear word in another language, in Gaelic. So, because I kept on trying to put my name in, and it wouldn't go through, and I got angry, and I said, Pokemon! And that's not such a good word somewhere else. But I feel like we can say it here in English, because I don't think anyone watching knows what I just said. So
You're getting letters, man.
Yeah, I know, exactly. If you do, you get a gold star. Lon, what do you do with Bebo? What do you do with the corpse?
You know, maybe the domain name has some value. I don't know. You know, I think to Tim's point, that there are some things that don't do very well in the United States at all and suddenly become huge overseas. You know, Orkut being a great example of that. You know, I was on there when it first came about. A few friends of mine were on there, too. We were communicating. And then all of a sudden, one day, I started getting a lot of people from Brazil friending me, and I couldn't understand a word anybody was telling me anymore. So maybe there's some hope that overseas this might have some value. There could be some value to the domain name. Maybe the back-end technology might be useful somewhere else. So I don't know enough about the site or what's contained in it to do that, but I certainly would love to get a couple million dollars for the things that I failed with too, but I guess
except after spending $850 million.
Yeah, that's true. I guess there is
a bit
of a loss.
That math, we don't know how much of that went in, how much of that was stock and cash and everything else. So when it's an $850 value, the question is are they getting cash now for something that they only gave stock for before? We don't know. I don't know the details of that deal. I'm sure they're not coming out ahead, but they may not be coming out as far behind as we may think. So we'll see. Lon, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Lon Seidman, LonSeidman. And I run a little news outfit called localonlinenews.tv. And you're welcome to check that out and tell me what you think.
Fantastic. And Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me on my blog at onetimstreet.com.
Fantastic. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.